Thank you, Karen. I realised this afternoon that I should have my head read for a greeting to talk to you today, because having the last slot at the end of a long day's work is not easy. But also, most of all, talking to editors and indexers is daunting. You folks are the best read people I talk to. You have more breadth and reading than pretty well any other group, and so I'm pretty confident that some of the things I'll say today will be familiar to at least some of you. Anyway, I begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land where we meet today and their elders, past and present. And I also must tell you that PowerPoint and I are not friends. Which is to say that I'm going to make minimal use of it to present a little bit of data and to summarise the key points of the argument. But most of the time I want to talk. It's about prescriptive and descriptive and also proscriptive in the background, things which you may not say or write or do. And the whole question about whether we should be talking about language is what it is or how it ought to be. Anyone who does Linguistics 101 will have had, during the first lecture, someone get up and say, those evil grammars and dictionaries are prescriptive. They try and button down the language in a way which is not faithful to the real, lively use of it. We are going to deal with real language, right? That's what linguists deal with, and those things aren't really quite in the same kind of basket. Well, that has led linguists to being regarded as left-wing and kind of irresponsible about the real standards of language as it is used. There was a book by John Honey in 1997, I think it was, called Language is Power. And he quite unashamedly said, there is a prestige accent, people use it, it gives you access to things which you would not have access to otherwise, and that's the way the things are. And of course it brought forth a howl from all sorts of people on ideological grounds. But it does seem to me true that there is a prestige form of our language, or prestige forms, right? And that it is relatively stabler than some of the other forms, and it's the sort of thing which we should be talking about. I got interested in prestige, forms, norms, and so on because I used to be a Slavic linguist. I still am in some ways. And among Slavs, the notion that language and country went together was only discovered around about 1900. This is rather strange. We tend to assume nowadays that a country will have a language, even though there are quite a few languages that don't have countries. Remember that there are about 6,900 languages still extant, according to Ethnologue, and so there aren't enough countries to go round. But nonetheless, the notion that if you have a variety of language, that gives you a right to an identity, and the identity gives you a right to a space with a geographical boundary around it, or a geopolitical boundary around it, this was something which was discovered by people like Schleicher and von Humboldt, and it was very much a continental European thing. That's led to all sorts of tensions in the 20th century. You know, is Serbian a different language from Croatian? People have gone to war over less. But it also means that we're left with the notion of language as something which exists nowadays with a kind of uneasy relationship with the places which define it geographically and politically. So a language is, as they say, a dialect with an army and a navy. If you have a variety and you've got enough authority to push it on other people, you call it a language. But languages are also coherent bodies of practices which we use to communicate with. And how does a language become a language? Well, in some cases, the users have said we have a language and not a variety or a dialect. But there are three things which languages really need. And those are, you need to have an agreed norm, and that can be established either top-down by some kind of fiat or powerful body, or it can be done bottom-up by usage. English has done a bit of both, but a great deal more bottom-up, say, than the French. And that results in a situation of power. Now, whether that is ideologically or ethically desirable or not is not what I want to talk about today. But in order to establish a language, you need practice, institutions, and instruments. Practice is people who use the language and give an example that it can be used for all sorts of purposes. The King James Bible in 1611 was a demonstration that English is suitable as a language for Scripture. Even before that, though, Tyndall, one of my personal heroes, had shown that this was really, really possible about 80 years before. But people like Chaucer, who died in 1400, or Shakespeare, who died in 1616, or in the 18th century, people like Pope and Dryden, showed that the language was able to deal with the highest subjects, in Chaucer's case, the lowest ones as well. But also in the 18th century, that English was at least up to being as elegant as French was and could live with the bienséance and things about good taste. The bottom-up exemplification of English in usage has been fundamental to the way it's grown up. And I can remember seeing things like cop this lot and they're a weird mob when they first came out. There was almost a shock of recognition. Now, here is our speech, but written. There's something wrong with that. But it had been recorded and so used. Institutions, well, Caxton set up his press in 1476. And that helped to establish sort of South Midlands and London variety and spelling as one of the standards. Before that, the manuscript tradition in England had been extraordinarily diverse and reflected the sorts of language that were used by scribes in different parts of the country. Or in 1870 in England, they produced the General Education Act, which meant that education would be available for all. That was an institution of enormous importance because, a bit like Caxton, it had brought literacy out of the special basket and made it available for many others. More particularly, perhaps, are instruments. And one of the most important instruments was Johnson's dictionary in 1755. Where he talks about fixing the language. The old beggar could certainly write, wouldn't he? Those who have been persuaded to think well of my design require that it should fix our language and put a stop to those alterations which time and chance have hitherto been suffered to make in it without opposition. And he goes on, when we see men grow old and die at certain time, one after another, from century to century, we laugh at the elixir that promises to prolong life to 1,000 years, and with equal justice may the lexicographer be derided, who, being able to produce no example of a nation that has preserved their words and phrases from mutability, shall imagine that his dictionary can embalm his language and secure it from corruption and decay. That is, that it is in his power to change sublunary nature or clear the world at once from folly, vanity, and affectation. In other words, here's my dictionary, I failed. But also, of course, Johnson's dictionary was the touchstone of English lexicography. It's the sort of thing that Webster used when he did his Dictionary of American English in 1828. But around about the same period as Johnson, and in the 50 years that followed, we get a whole rash of normative grammars by people like Louth, who were basing their ideas on Latin and tried to make English behave like Latin. I think it was Dryden who set up the rule that you shouldn't end a sentence with a preposition. And that, of course, is entirely false. Germanic languages do this all the time. This is a piece of tomfoolery up with which I will not put. Or even better, what did you bring that book I didn't want to be read to out of up for? Bring me the child who said that. There was an enormous interest in normative and prestige language at this time because Johnson had said not only how words should be spelt, but also how they should be used and what they meant. And when we get to the 19th century, Webster, picking up Johnson's lead, produced not only the dictionary, but also the Blue Speller, an enormously important book which kids used. It was the second best-selling book in America after the Bible, and from which generations of children learned to spell. S-E-T, sec, R-E-T, ret, and so on, for secretary. They chanted these things. In the 20th century, we kept on with the prestige pursuit. The Oxford Dictionary came out as a book in 1928, but round about then we had books like Nesfield. Have any of you seen Nesfield? Extraordinary old thing, which was compendious and authoritative, and it said what was in the language and what was not. And it was absolutely clear about it. Strunk and White in 1919, their style book for America, where they said that Gotham was an abomination that should never be used. Bad luck. Fowler in 1926. And a little bit later, I mean, these books had an extraordinary influence because as a result of the way we were taught, we have developed biases about English which have guided our aesthetics and our judgment. And people, when you produce a sentence ending in a preposition, you know, this is such stuff as dreams are made on, if Shakespeare can do it, so can I. But when you do that, a lot of people twinge. You know, this is bad, and you start a sentence with and they say terrible. Oh, the Bible does it, why shouldn't we? Splitting an infinitive, okay, you know. But they actually have induced in us a kind of almost physical resistance to aspects of English which are quite native to it. The Texas Manual of Style had a rule which said that you weren't able to put an adverb in the middle of a compound verb form. So if you've got will go, you can't put an adverb in the middle. And that had a really interesting and perverse realization when poor President Obama was getting inaugurated. I don't know if you remember this, but the Chief Justice couldn't get the words right. He was trying to say, which the oath says, will faithfully execute. But Texas was looking over his shoulder and he tried to say, will execute faithfully. And Obama was trying to put him right. And they had this little arabesque of words for a while. The point I'm making is that these normative instruments cast a long shadow. And they have cast shadows which in some cases are quite nefarious. What we have learnt as being prescriptive, in some cases, started out as descriptive. Johnson realised that there was a problem of description and prescription. But what we have learnt, I think, has helped us to develop, you know, some kinds of biases. Now, I want to talk to you specifically about pronunciation, because that is one of the areas where prescriptivism has had the most obvious and, in some cases, agonising effects. In the 18th century, a man called John Walker produced a dictionary in 1791 and was one of the arbiters of good pronunciation. And in these days, the rising middle class had an absolute fear that they would sound regional. Now, you did not want to sound regional because they aspired to the privileges of the upper classes, and the upper classes had already begun to speak in an identifiably RP sort of way. RP was rather later, but they had a form of words which identified them as a class. And so you could hire a tutor to improve the pronunciation of your children, that they should marry into money and the people upstairs. And regionalisms were regarded as one of the great shibboleths. In the 19th century, A.J. Ellis, who was a very cluey phonetician, said that the emerging RP was not a single variety. It was, in fact, subject to a number of variations which might depend on where you came from. You know, there could be a Scottish RP and so on. But fundamentally, the idea of there being a prestigious variety to which people would aspire was put in his 1917 dictionary by Jones. And he wrote this: the pronunciation used in this book, and he said in the just before this that he was trying to be descriptive, is that most generally heard in the families of Southern English persons, whose menfolk have been educated at the great public boarding schools. If you've been to Eton and Harrow, you have learned how to enunciate. Right. This pronunciation is also used by a considerable portion of those who do not come from the south of England, but who have been educated at these schools. Description, my eye. This was setting up something to be a prestigious object, and it was faithfully followed by many people in the years that followed. Now, when you get to the OED, for example, you get an extraordinary difficulty, because Murray, the editor, did realise that English, in educated usage, did allow variation. And so he had a terrible fight with some of the other editors over words like golf. Now, golf for us always has an L. But in those days, there was a prestigious pronunciation, goff, without the L. And should forehead be forehead or forehead? Forehead was already on the way in, and in fact you see that there is a spelling pronunciation which is pushing its way into the area. And they resisted, Bradley in particular, one of the editors of the OED, resisted all he could against golf and forehead, but of course time has overtaken both of them. Now, the sorts of things which the spelling books of the 18th and 19th centuries derided as being improper included the rhotic R. Now, my folks come from Devon in Somerset, and down there they are butter, they do. You weren't allowed to have a post-vocalic R. You had to say hunting and shooting, although in the early 20th century, hunt and shooting and fishing was something that Lord Peter Wimsey did. It was a feature of the top and the bottom classes, and it was only the middle classes that adhered to the ing pronunciation. You had to say cut, not cut, the way you would if you lived in Yorkshire, say. I won't do Yorkshire. You were not allowed to have glottal stops. They were definitely bad. There was, at the end of the 18th century, a really interesting fight over whether you should pronounce bath or bath. And the one which was favoured by Walker was bath. And bath was regarded as a vulgar regionalism. Interestingly, of course, they were wrong. And over the next 50 years, the thing righted itself the other way that we now recognise. But perhaps most of all, and these are really obvious examples of prestige at work, is the poor old letter H. There was a book written by an author who called himself the Honourable Henry H. And it was called The Poor Letter H, Its Use and Abuse. And it could be bought in London in 1854 for sixpence. And it told you when you should pronounce H and when you should not. Now, of course, as you and I know, this is not easy, because Dickens has had a Uriah Heep saying, I'm very humble. And there are words which we've borrowed from French, which are written with an H, and some of them pronounce it and some of them don't. Now, the Anglo-Saxons one with H, like hut and hit and so on, that's fine, they've got a pronounced H. But words like honour do not. In 1920, hotel was hotel, and you put up at an hotel. Right? And it was only in the next 30 years, possibly connected with the demotic habits of the Second World War, that people really started saying hotel, and it now is clearly, of course, a consonant. Humble has a consonant. Humour at one stage did not. It was humour, much closer to the French. And so getting your H's right was a matter of some delicacy. And even nowadays we have the problem of, is it ahistoric or anhistoric? The rule is, if an H word is stressed on the first syllable, that's a consonant H, it's nice and strong, it's a history. If it's stressed on the second syllable, the H is weaker, and so it can be either ahistoric or anhistoric. Pam has probably got numbers for these things. But here we can see the issues of description and prescription getting themselves well and truly mixed up and problematic. The pronunciation thing in the 20th century followed on. There were elocution classes, particularly in girls' schools, which shows you that pronunciation was not a matter of gender equity at that stage. And it was the Oxbridge and great public schools accents in Britain that won. Think of Pygmalion and Artford, Edward and Hampshire. And other things with Eliza Doolittle, which I'll come to later on. The BBC in the 1920s provided a means for propagating a prestige accent. And Lord Reith was absolutely clear that his newsreaders, all male, would purvey a tone and a decorum of the upper classes. He actually had his newsreaders wear dinner suits at the microphone. They couldn't be seen, but it made them feel that they were formally present on air. During the war, the BBC decided it should try to be a little bit more embracing, and it included a man called Wilfred Pickles from Yorkshire as one of its newsreaders. He didn't last long. There was an absolute howl. This was not the sort of language that the BBC should be propagating. But J.B. Priestley was a Yorkshireman, and he talked like that and was very popular. He had a million listeners to his programmes. And so gradually the bastion of RP started falling a bit. In the 1950s, commercial television reached Britain. In the 1960s, we see the Beatles, and in the 1970s, Steptoe and Son, who were definitely not upper class. And in 1984, we find the formal coronation of Estuary English, which is the sort of English spoken around around London and the Estuary counties, and which has now taken over from RP. There was a survey a while ago at Winchester School, and they presented some RP to the boys and said, you talk like this, and I said, no, that's thought to be very much a nose-in-the-air stuff. We talk like Estuary English. I once said on radio that the Queen's vowels had moved in 50 years, and someone misheard me. But this is true. Her early messages, her Christmas messages, were incredibly Australia. You know? She has changed. How many of you were Argonauts with the ABC? Yay, good. You may remember the Argonauts as being, they had a jolly good time. Right? And the accents of the ABC for the Argonauts and the news and current affairs were exclusively British. I left Australia for New Zealand in 56, came back in 74, and I missed the switchover. When I came back, Graham Kennedy was in full flood, and so was his dog Rover, all over the studio floor. And this is, I think, ways in which, you know, Australian English has come of age. Amongst us, at the moment, the only British voice that you hear on TV is Lilian Chin, who reads the news for SBS in the weekend, and who has an exquisite Hong Kong RP accent. Okay? The other thing that's happening, by the way, and which is now taking over very much among younger people, is creaky voice. I'm a crows. And you will hear particularly younger females here and in America and in lots of other places doing creaky voice. Okay, that's a lovely illustration, and one which I really do like, about the way in which prestige and description and prescription, and in the case of pronunciations of your H, proscription, have played out their way in English. I'm also an editor, a slightly different sort. I'm not a professional editor in your sense, but I edit academic books and I've edited academic journals. And at the moment, I'm editing a book of papers from a conference we did in Macau last December on English and communication in Asia. I have 12 authors, of whom 3 are native speakers of English. And we had another similar conference 4 years ago. And the thing of editing that, now this is an international audience. The publisher was Springer. How much should I edit not only the content but also the manner of their writing? Now this is tricky, because over-editing would take away their voice, but then it would make the book less homogeneous and perhaps make it sound a little less quote-unquote professional. And yet, as you and I know, English has taken root in every country in Asia. It has local variants. There's Chinglish in China and Japanese in Japan and Manglish in Malaysia and Taglish in the Philippines because of Tagalog, right? And Singlish and others. And they have their own local norms, which are, in the written form, almost indistinguishable from ours, not so in India, but which in pronunciation, of course, show local versions. This was a really challenging thing, because I talked to all the authors and said, I will help you understand which bits would not be the way academic authors would naturally write in English according to me. You can then choose, and we can argue about what you want in and what out. But there was, for example, the issue of rhetorics. There's a linguist in Japan called Hino who teaches English, whose English is very nice, but who maintains that his students should be allowed to write essays in English which follow a Japanese pattern of composition. Now, in 1966, a linguist called Kaplan wrote a paper which he now desperately wishes he'd never written at all. But he basically says that in the Western world, your structure of argumentation is pretty much a straight line, you know, from the beginning to the end. He said that the Russians start here and then tend to do this. And if you do an analysis of Russian rhetorics, you'll find that that is true. And in an Asian letter, you start and it's like an expanding spiral like this. If you write a business letter in Malaysia in English and you are Malay writing for Malays, you say, you will remember that we met last summer and you told me about your children. I hope they've passed their exams and that your wife is now better and that blah, 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 blah. The middle of page 2, you may remember that we talked about a possibility for business collaboration. And then the actual business happens. If you miss out the first page and a half, you are regarded as being terribly brusque and lacking in any kind of manners. And this is in English, all right, in an Asian country. Now, some of my authors adopted that kind of rhetorical pattern in producing analyses of English in their countries. And we had a really interesting, for me it was aesthetic, ethical, cognitive, all sorts of things. And we negotiated and negotiated and negotiated. Some of the papers have more the voice of the indigenous writers. Some of them felt, they told me, look, just go for it, do it your way and I'll be happy. I was light in editing. But the form of language, in a case like this, with an international audience, an international collection of authors, all right, about something which is now a matter of urgent intellectual interest in Asia, presented me with a problem that I hadn't faced before. There was, of course, the issue of US versus UK spelling. Well, that was fairly easy. We just asked the publisher. But morphology had to be standard. We felt that there was no point in leaving out plurals and agreements. I was in KL Airport a while ago, and it said, I think it was health station ahead. to measure your temperature in degree. I went through the airport 3 months later and somebody had stuck an S at the end of degrees. In other words, it wasn't worth changing the entire sign, but they recognised that there was something which they wanted to do. Most Asian languages do not mark plural, right? So that the English plural is often left out, just is the English agreement of singular subjects and singular verbs. Vocabulary in the book that I was doing was not too bad. Some of the authors tended to overuse get, and there were definite problems with collocations. But on the whole, because this was, after all, an academic book written by academics, for academics, it wasn't too bad. Over here, however, and in any English-speaking country, the language is on the move, and this has to be the only gathering in Australia where people would get absolutely excited over N dashes and M dashes. And it was splendid. Thank you, Pam and Adam, for that. And we've been worried for years about the I-S-E-I-Z-E thing. Gotten has now arrived, I'm afraid, and is regularly used in print among some of our less careful newspapers, but also some of the ordinary ones. People are starting to use spit and fit as past tenses, as they use dove as a past tense. All of these are American. And I think it's because the American detective novel is so dominant in the market at the moment. Some marvellous writing. And I also read Janet Ivanovich when my daughter's finished with it. But we also have things like prepositional use, you know, Monday through Friday. Okay, well, from Monday to Friday, the younger generation doesn't even know that there was ever a way of saying it otherwise. Are you on the team or in the team? The papers and the football tonight will say on the team. And it's on the weekend, not in the weekend or at the weekend. I think prepositions are a lost cause almost. Within a generation, we will no longer remember that they were ever otherwise. Other things I've noticed have been joining Lee and I. Not me. I recorded that the other night from one of the football programs. But I regret to say this, I once heard Dame Judi Dench do it in an unscripted piece. And the sky fell. Chicken Little and everything else descended. I think what happened was that kids were told at school, no, Jim and I are going to the shop. Jim and me are going to the shop. No, Jim and I. And they got the idea that after the word and, you have to have I rather than me. And therefore, you know, he gave it to Jim and I, you know, he went to the school with Jim and I, or whatever. It is now becoming, I think, the default among people under about 20, unless you went to a school which was rather careful about such things.
Hmm?
Under 40, all right. Any advance on 40? Sam Neill, last week in a marvellous program, TV program about the Anzacs, talked about a bloody stuff-up. Now, he meant, of course, that he was using a stuff-up in the sense of it was a terrible mess, which it was. But, of course, bloody was something that when I was at school, children were taken away and punished for. One of the little boys in my class had his mouth washed out with that awful soap for daring to say bloody. Nowadays, Mr. Beattie uttered it in Queensland Parliament about 7 years ago, and there was barely a frisson of worry in the back benches. You know, it has come of age and nobody pays any attention to it. But the fact that Neil could use it in a program of immense serious respectfulness about the Anzacs, I think said a lot about the way in which the word has been rehabilitated. And he is a person whose use of language I very much respect. He did it, obviously, quite deliberately, playing on both meanings of bloody at once, with, I think, great effect. Now, these things are relevant for us because it's obvious over the last 30, 40 years that the spoken language has pushed its way, elbowed its way, into the written medium in a way which was not possible before. And if you have a look at the editorials of newspapers in the 1950s, they sound stiff and mannered and deliberate. And all of their subordinate clauses are there, stacked up one after the other. It's almost like Macaulay writing his history with sentences that went on for a page and a half, thanks to heavy punctuation. What's happened, of course, is that our written English now sounds much more like our spoken English. But it's left us with another sort of problem. And I want to address this. Here we are. Over the issues of changing norms. I think that what used to be a reasonably well-defined norm, even if it was not always obeyed, has disintegrated somewhat. I can remember that at school we had a fairly good idea about what was in English, it was what is in Nesfield, and what was in the dictionary. And that gave you at least a point of reference, if not a very sensitive one. We talked differently behind the shelter sheds, we talked differently amongst ourselves. But there's a lovely story at the beginning of a Macquarie, when the early compilers of the Macquarie went out to Liverpool and they found some real talkers of Australian English, and they said to these blokes, would you like to come into the studio and record at the university? And they said, yeah, I'll do that. And they brought them to the University of Sydney, plonked them down in... Macquarie. Put them down in front of a microphone, and suddenly their English had taken a couple of steps upwards. But we all used to do this. I mean, my English is a mongrel. It changes all over the place. It lived in New Zealand, it's lived in Europe, it's lived in England, it's lived in Australia. But one of the things which I think has come upon us is, first of all, the issue of English as a pluricentric language. Pluricentric is a language which has more than one place to look for its models. Now, for 200 years almost, our model was British. I'm pleased to say that it's now going the other way round, and that high-rising town is turning up in London, and there are letters to the Times about this. They don't like it at all. But in a nation which watches Home and Away and Neighbours for a whole hour, 5 days a week, it's hardly surprising. Monocentric languages are geographically and politically coherent, like Japan. They have a very strong education system and a top-down imposition of an accepted norm. And educated Tokyo Japanese is what counts. Sometimes, as in Italy, they were trying to make unity in Italy is like trying to herd cats through a farm gate. But the Accademia della Crusca in the 16th century, Crusca, by the way, means bran, a lovely way of doing a name. They were trying to make sense out of bran. And, of course, the French Academy in 1634. But we don't have academy. Many times in the 19th century they tried and failed, and I doubt if it's possible now with nearly 2 billion English speakers around the world. But the monocentric ones, coherent geographical space, not too much overseas extension. All right? And if there is, you have a way of telling these people how they ought to talk. So that Putonghua, which is standard Chinese, is the way which is propagated from Beijing and taught to Chinese in every place where Chinese lived. In Korea, I think there are two, because of political reasons, but there are none that has very clear ideas about a centric version. You know where to go for the proper version of the language, right? Proper inquiry. And the same is very much true of all the Baltic states, they're small and coherent, of Russia, of Poland, which I know something about. Pluricentric ones include... Well, English is the really good example, because English has not only Britain and America, but also we have our own local centre. And I think we are now quite loyal to Australian English, and the fact that very, very few British voices are heard in public life here is an example of that. When I was a kid, most of the churchmen, the senior churchmen, were Irish if they were Catholic, they were Scots if they were Protestant, possibly Welsh if they were Methodist, but they were certainly British if they were... I think the first Australian Governor General was Sir Isaac Isaacs, who was appointed in 1936. It's almost as if we thought that people who spoke Australian couldn't quite cut the mustard. You know, and we had to go overseas to become famous, like Howard Florey. Now, pluricentric languages include Germany, because, of course, there's Swiss German, Austrian German, and Lower German and Upper German and Plattdeutsch and so on. And in spite of the poor old French... because in Quebec, the French Canadians have a very clear idea about centricity. But for us, we first of all had this single line of centricity to England. Then we had kind of America hanging off the side with the talking films. When I was young in Melbourne in the 50s, OK was thought of as being a slightly showy way of saying yes. It is now one of the two most recognised words in the world. The other one is Coke. And both of them are American English. I'm not joking. Okay. English as an international language has come, and I'm afraid is not going to go away. From our point of view, it's a great benefit. We can go anywhere and we get on a plane and we don't have to learn another language. But it also makes us extraordinarily lazy. And the notion of English going forth with its own norms has taken a bit of a battering as well. Remember, by the way, that there is something called Globish, which is a 1,500-word cut-down version of English. invented by a Frenchman called Nerriere, working for IBM. Globish is a kind of way of saying you don't need to learn all of English, you can manage with a basically limited subset of. There's also, now EIL, English as an International Language, has a very well-established literature, there are journals about it, and a linguist called Jenkins in England has said, now listen, when you speak in EIL, you don't really need to try and do the full Monty. Don't worry about THs. People will understand if you say this and that, which is probably true, right? And there are various other bits of English like, you know, I would have had something, no, pre-perfect. You don't really need those. You can manage without. So that the idea is that you could do violence to English and arrive at a viable, respected international means of communication is something that would probably have made Johnson turn over in his grave. Not only do we have English as an international language, we have lingua franca English. And this is where two people who don't share a language other than bits of English manage to communicate as if in a pidgin together. And you'll find people almost inventing bits of English to communicate in the bazaar in Malaysia. I've witnessed it, and you know, I sat behind a pillar and wrote it down as it happened. There is extraordinary variation in this sort of English, but it's very important. Going along with this with diglossia, a lovely Greek word which means two tongues, but really it means two varieties of, particularly in our case, standard language. Australians are pretty good at diglossia. I talk one way to, if you can find someone to fill your car with petrol, if you say, fill it up, man, you'll be waiting till next week. You know, fill it up, mate, you're right. But we change our speech when we go overseas, that horrible man at Heathrow in the other column who receives your passport and your application for entry. You know, if you say, I've just got off the plane from Australia, they let me through rather quickly. Interestingly, speakers from large Englishes tend to be bad at diglossia. The Americans are not good at it. And I know some people from both extremely upper class and extremely lower class levels who also have basically one variety of English. But we are surrounded by a sea of English. And if you listen to the TV after 2 a.m., you will hear only American Englishers of various sorts. Around us every day we have Jamaican English, New Zealand English, South African English. There are lots of them here today, I know. And various sorts of British English and various sorts of continental English. Con the fruiterer, right? Beautiful, right? And Aboriginal Englishers. In other words, we are passively able to understand an extraordinary variety of English, whereas before we weren't. On the other hand, talking different Englishes, not so good. And in fact, learning other languages, which is another of my hobby horses, definitely not good. We've got to get better at this, and we've also got to get better at managing the proliferation of English on the one hand, probably well over 1 million words, possibly 2 billion speakers, with the proliferation of English and information on the web. I'm on the board of the State Library of Queensland, and we are developing a policy of what I love to call information curation. You curate an exhibition by choosing the works, putting them on the wall, and writing a catalogue. You curate information by providing a guide to its interpretation. And this is immensely important to people who are building indexes and thesauruses and other things for information on the web. In 1945, it was estimated that knowledge was doubling every 25 years. The recent estimate from IBM, 3 months ago, is that knowledge is now doubling every 11 months. That is absolutely terrifying. And how on earth can we hope to keep pace with this? Well, indexing is one way. And of course, indexing is being done by the NSA and others. With every tweet you send and every phone call you make, something is being recorded somewhere and kept in a database for possible later investigation. This is data mining, but it's also indexing. And the notion that you can have a kind of breadcrumb stream of things which will take you from A to Z, I think is desperately, desperately insufficient. So the indexes among us have, I think, a save the planet job as well, because we somehow must take control of this proliferation of information and make something out of it. I have an example from one of my research projects on the language of pain, about which I've talked to several of you. It turns out that instead of having clear electrical images of pain from your brain if you put electrodes on someone's head and do an EEG, it doesn't give you clear indication of whether there is pain there or not. There are people who have enormous brain activity with no pain and huge pain with nothing showing up here. So the way you talk about it is vital. I'm a linguist. I talk about pain from the point of view of a socio-cultural linguist, but I'm working with people in medicine, occupational therapy, psychiatry, neurology, and all sorts of other things. And we publish in journals which are not normally read by people who know anything about linguistics. So we have to build our, not only our keywords, but the information structure of what we write and the choice of words itself to address an audience of linguists, sociolinguists, cultural linguists, neurologists, specialists in fibromyalgia, people who know about somatization, people who know about neuropathy and nociceptive pain, people who work in analgesics and anesthetics, people who work in communication studies. You see the problem? It's a way of trying to manage interdisciplinary space in a way which is going to be accessible and to bring the research that we've done into the conceptual domains of the people who are reading it. In order to do that, you need to put on the front of these pieces explanatory paragraphs, which, if you like, wrap together all of the people who are going to be reading it and help them to get an idea of the framework in which this stuff makes sense. Because for a neurologist, the stuff that I talk, if I talk like a linguist, will make no sense at all. We have to find ways, and as indexers and editors, you do this because you are dealing with books in all sorts of ways for audiences, some of whom you may not even be aware of. Okay. Towards a conclusion, and this is very preliminary. First of all, prescriptivism is on the way down. The rewards for talking proper are less and less evident, and the rewards, I think, for being articulate are still there, but you can be articulate with many different sorts of accents, and it needn't be an Australian or even a British accent. The notion of prestige has changed, and although there is still a lot of resentment about the idea of a prestige variant, I'm sorry, but it is there, and it exists, and it is used. Among these are three things about the Oxford comma. Have some of you seen this? Okay. You know what the Oxford comma is, and this came courtesy of The Guardian. Amongst those interviews were Merle Haggard's two ex-wives, Chris Christopherson and Robert Duvall. The Oxford comma would have saved us. This book is dedicated to my parents, Ayn Rand and God. But even better, and without any disrespect, highlights of Peter Ustinov's global tour included encounters with Nelson Mandela, an 800-year-old demigod and a dildo collector. As professional editors, what are you going to do to save the author from ignominy? It's an interesting thing. Go back to the Oxford comma. Even Oxford has backed off from the Oxford comma and said, in Oxford publications, this is no longer expected. All right? And as Pam and Adam showed us earlier, punctuation is very definitely on the back foot at the moment. Not to mention the poor old apostrophe. But then I realised that prestige language actually has a financial benefit. 3 days ago I received this message: customer satisfaction survey, win $50. But you'll see that the dollar and the 50 are inverted. Congratulations! You have been selected by Woolworths Online Department. And it was in green and gold. It looked sort of authentic. To take part in our quick and easy reward survey. I don't know what an easy reward survey is, but never mind. In return, we will credit $50 to your account just for your bang time. Bang. Right. Obviously, this is not something that Woolworths would send out. And in fact, the authenticity of language is one of the interesting ways in which English has reclaimed some of its standard as a norm. I knew that this thing was a fish right away with a PH and did not respond to it, although I was tempted to send something rather nasty to them. There was more which you can read if you want. We need, I think, instruments which we can relate to, which are updated. Now the style guide, Adam, if it's here, we'd like the new version quickly, please. But also, our dictionaries are moving very fast. The Oxford Dictionary has just announced this past week that it's going to include MX for Mr. or Ms. Now remember, we've so far got rid of much of the gender differentiation between nouns Okay? The only place where you find actor-actress is in the Logies and the Oscars. But other than that, fireman has become fire officer, has become firey in Australia. Ambulance officer, ambulance man has become ambulance officer, has become amber. Great, we've solved that one. But MX, X is the unknown quantity. It can stand for S or R. So it's either Mrs. or Mr. You pronounce it, according to the gurus, either mux, mix or mux, which is the only unstressed schwa in English. This has to be a bad idea. There may be a noble intention behind that, but they've got the wrong instrument, I'm afraid. However, we do badly need people like you who know roughly where English is and what to do with it and how fuzzy the edges are, and this is the interesting part. I think one of the most interesting questions at the moment is, can we have a core of English? Is there a sort of globish, you know, but rather much more than that, something which can be used for personal, professional, social, touristic purposes? There is something called medical tourism, where Australians and other people go overseas for particularly elective surgery. And so you find a German patient in a Thai hospital talking English to a Thai surgeon and a Filipino nurse. We need varieties of English which are stable, understood, and which are going to be effective enough for important professional purposes. And this is something which we haven't at all solved yet. It seems to me a matter of great importance, because what's happened to English is changing the language. Marshall McLuhan once said that the medium is the message. This was in the 60s, and he was talking about advertising. I think it is now clear that the medium, boxes like this, are actually making the message in a different image. Because the sort of language which is generated on these things is not the sort of English that I learned to write longhand. The reason I asked our first speaker the other day, Jackie French, does she write with a pen, is that I asked David Malouf this a while ago, and he said, no, I write with a pen. And that is the right sort of rhythm and the right sort of speed in order for me to produce quality prose. That's interesting. One of the few things I now use longhand for is lecture notes. The rest, I think, on a machine. We're building MOOCs at UQ, and MOOCs are massive open online courses, and it has been discovered that the optimal length of a chunk of learning material is about 8 minutes. There's not a lot of prose you can get through in 8 minutes on a screen. And the screen itself is forcing us to be shorter and more telegraphic. Our syntax is becoming simpler. We use fewer complex sentences, because what can be put on a screen, which can be consumed easily, is definitely not the same as what we could write on a page and a half of Macaulay. So we need you. We need people who know where English is and what it is and how its bits work and how the different bits may belong to pieces of English just outside the penumbra, but which may, if you go to that country, become part of the standard. It's all about the speech and about its relation to information and about how we interpret this incredible changing kaleidoscope of our beloved and cussed language. Thank you. I should acknowledge two splendid books which I read in preparing this material and which I'm sure you'd love. Linda Muggleston's book, Talking Proper. It's about the history of, if you like, prestige phonetics through the ages of English. And Anne Curzon's book, Fixing English. She's using Johnson's term, fixer, right? Prescriptivism and Language History. Strongly recommend. Happy reading.
Very much, Robert. You did well, despite it being Friday afternoon, late at the end of the conference. So it was absolutely fascinating.